Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Football is fun. Why shouldn't your football podcast be the same?
Follow and listen to Heed the Call NFL podcast with Dan Hansis and Mark Sessler wherever you get your podcasts.
215-592-9494. Rob Cherry in for Glenn Mack now with Mike Sielski. At some point, Mike, I want to discuss your new book project, which
sounds great.
I find fascinating. A couple questions I have to start the hour, then we'll do this day in Eagle history. There's one particular item that I thought was fascinating. Well, the questions are these. This is the dilemma that we've had, I guess, in Philadelphia for years. And we used to pose this question years ago at WIP before they won a Super Bowl. Would you rather have 10 years of contending or one Super Bowl?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Glenn and I were talking about this a little bit last week. I opt for the 10 years of contending. I think most fans, whether they want to admit it or not, actually feel that way. That my theory is that most fans enjoy the ride. They want, for all the heat that Andy Reid took, for instance, when he was the head coach here, those seasons in 2000, 2001 through 4, when they finally got to the Super Bowl, that team was really good every week, and so every game mattered. I think the flip side of that, do you want to win the Super Bowl once and then be irrelevant for the 9 years thereafter? I don't think most people want that. I think they want to feel like they are going along for the ride, and contention is what people really want.
Yeah, but people wanted at one point to feel like a champion, to feel like the team finally, and they did in 2017, obviously. Since then, they've made the playoffs several times, but they've never gotten close.
Right, and I think it's generated, I always kind of chuckle when I speak to friends of mine, either in the sports media or who aren't, from outside the Philadelphia area, who suggest that, like, well, the Eagles won the Super Bowl, or back in 2008 when the Phillies won the World Series. So that dark cloud of negativity that hangs over Philadelphia must have lifted now. And it's like, no, you don't understand Philadelphia.
It's back.
They want more of that. We want more of that. You know, the Phillies gave us a taste. The Eagles gave us a taste. And we want to taste it again. And that feeling never kind of goes away. So the contention is what you're looking for. The feeling that there's a chance, I think, is what really drives interest in sports.
Yeah, but imagine here in 2022, the Phillies hadn't won in 2008, the Eagles hadn't won in 2017. How would we feel? We'd never know what it felt like to cover a champion or to root for a champion.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, my gosh, Rob, we could do a PhD thesis about the thinking and the feeling and the mentality of Philadelphia sports fans. I think it's changed a little bit over time, but it's always a topic that I just find totally interesting in the way people approach sports in this city. It's amazing to me.
Well, you're welcome. It's an idea for your next book.
All right, I'll see what I can do.
All right, so the other question I want to throw, and it's for you, it's also for the audience. It's a question you were asked when you were on the morning show, I think it was Thursday?
Yeah, I think so.
Thursday on the morning show. And I want to ask our audience as well. You were asked about whether you would love to be at the U.S. Open to cover Serena's last hurrah. And your answer was?
My answer was, I wouldn't mind, I would enjoy doing it, but I'm not sure how much interest there is to a Philadelphia viewership or readership in the U.S. Open, even with Serena Williams making a run and potentially playing there for the last time.
All right, so the question I have for our listeners and your readers as well, paper in the paper, is there an athlete or a sport you wish we would talk about more on the radio or have Mike write about more in the newspaper?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, Rob. We were talking about this before the show, in that when you're in our position, right, and you're deciding what to talk about or what to cover, you often don't know that you should be talking about or covering a thing until that thing happens, right? Like, no, maybe nobody's paying attention to the Masters 1 year, but all of a sudden Tiger Woods enters and goes 6 under the first day. And Tiger Woods has no connection to Philadelphia, nothing tangible anyway, but it becomes the thing that you're talking about at barbecues or with your buddies having a beer or whatever the case may be. And if you're not already there, if you're not anticipating that that might happen, you're left out. And I don't know how many stories there are like that for us in the Philadelphia area, because we are so parochial, because ratings for the teams here are so high, and generally speaking, ratings here for big national sporting events, whether you're talking about the Super Bowl or the NBA Finals, tend to be lower than they are throughout the rest of the country because we care so much about what's going on here.
But there are some stories that just transcend everything.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And some
so
of them.
I'd be curious to hear what people have to say about that, because that's a I'm curious to know what those stories are.
Yeah, what is Mike not covering? What is the Inquirer not covering? Or what are we not covering at WIP that you would like to hear more about?
Yeah, tell us how we're messing up and not doing our jobs well.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Or let us, how do we do our jobs better?
Yes.
Instead of just talking about the Phillies and Eagles and Sixers and, I guess, once in a while, the Flyers as well. All right, before we do this day in Eagle history, I want to get Brian from Middletown on. Brian, you're on 94 WIP.
Hey, good morning, guys. Pleasure to speak with you.
You too, Brian.
Yep, and that's interesting. You're talking about different issues to cover because, you know, in the social media era, obviously you can kind of get the news you want, the sports coverage you want, by seeking it out. So, you know, I think it just sort of changes the landscape of sort of major newspapers and outlets. But that is an interesting question. And, Mike, I want to compliment you for your work on Kobe Bryant, your writing.
Oh, thank you, Brian. I appreciate that.
Yep. So now with that, then I have to come with some criticism.
Bring it, man. Bring it.
And it's not just towards you, really. I think it's recovering the Eagles. It's interesting. I understand the focus on the quarterback, and he certainly has to be held accountable. But to me, the one person who seems to be getting a pass is Nick Sirianni. He's a guy who was hired. He's an offensive-minded head coach. He doesn't call plays. That's okay. But a part of your responsibility, you saw this with Andy Reid, you have to develop a quarterback. Sean McVay showed that. And it's interesting, you dropped certain names of quarterbacks last season who clearly are better physically than Jalen Hurts. Justin Herbert, he didn't make the playoffs. Aaron Rodgers, he gets bounced in the first round. And again, I'm not, obviously Hurts is not that level. The point is, head coaching matters. And for me, if Hurts does not succeed, because I actually see his success connected to Nick Sirianni, which everyone seems to talk about as if, well, Hurts is separate, and if that doesn't work, well, we just move on. Well, you move on, I think Nick Sirianni only gets one more quarterback. This is not an area where you're waiting for the head coach to get a Hall of Fame quarterback. That doesn't work. You have to develop a guy. So for me, I'm kind of interested in hearing your take on like how you're evaluating Nick Sirianni, because I think Hurts can put up some big numbers. Just like Dak Prescott, just like Justin Herbert, and then you could be at the end of the season saying, well, darn, maybe the head coach just wasn't good enough.
Brian,
thank you, guys.
No, thank you, Brian, and I think you make a great, great point, and it's actually one that I wrote about in this offseason, which is if you take a look at the head coaches that Jeffrey Lurie has hired during his tenure as the Eagles chairman, you had Ray Rhodes.
Who was not his first choice.
Who was not his first choice. He wanted Dick Vermeil, looked elsewhere.
But he was coach of the year his first year.
Yes, he was. You had Ray Rhodes, you had Andy Reid, you had Chip Kelly, Doug Peterson, and now Nick Sirianni. Okay? Ray Rhodes' quarterbacks during his tenure as the Eagles head coach were Rodney Peete and Randall Cunningham, Ty Detmer, Bobby Hoying. Not exactly a group of Hall of Famers.
And Randall, he had basically checked out. He obviously got revived in Minnesota, but he had checked out, and it just didn't work. And Gruden clashed, I guess.
Exactly. Look at Andy Reid, right? Makes the smart decision to draft Donovan McNabb.
Over our protest for Ricky Williams.
Exactly. They stay together for, what, 9-10 years? Everything's hunky-dory. Once they trade McNabb, and I'm not suggesting they shouldn't have traded McNabb. It was time for that to end. But then you get inconsistency.
Well, Kevin Cobb was the guy they drafted to replace him.
Right. Kevin Cobb, Michael Vick. You know, Vick has a 7-week stretch in 2010 where he's incredible, not quite as incredible the next couple of years. 3 years after they trade Donovan McNabb, Andy Reid gets fired. Chip Kelly. Now, there's a lot you can say about Chip Kelly's tenure with the Eagles, but his quarterbacks were, again, Michael Vick, inconsistent and injured. Nick Foles played great one year, was not so great in 2014 before he got hurt.
I didn't think he was that bad when he got hurt.
Well, he wasn't great, let me put it that way. And then you have Mark Sanchez and Sam Bradford, okay? Again, a lot of instability at that position. Kelly lasts less than 3 years. And again, the quarterback situation isn't the only reason he was fired. Doug Peterson comes in, you draft Carson Wentz. You have Nick Foles as a backup. Everything is great. But as soon as Wentz's relationship with the team falls apart in 2020, not only do they trade Wentz, they get rid of Doug Peterson. I'm saying all that to say, as Brian mentioned, there is a lot at stake for Nick Sirianni here with Jalen Hurts. If Hurts does not play well enough where the Eagles say, okay, we're going to stick with him, or, you know what, Nick knows what he's doing, we just need to upgrade the quarterback, then eventually Sirianni's going to have to wonder about his future. I'm not saying that's happening anytime soon.
Well, Hurts is not his guy. He didn't draft Hurts. He preceded him.
Right. But what I am saying is, I think to Brian's point, Brian might have said this explicitly, and I think he's right. It's not like they're going to cycle through a whole bunch of quarterbacks for Nick Sirianni. Jeffrey Lurie doesn't do that. He gets a head coach. That head coach gets a guy who they hope is going to work out. And if it doesn't, the quarterback may be gone and the coach may be gone too. So it's really an interesting dynamic. And, you know, especially in the modern NFL where a coach can have a lot of power or not very much power. Look at the Rams, for instance. Okay. Sean McVay comes in and all of a sudden Jared Goff actually looks like a player who should have been the number one overall pick, except that in time it becomes apparent that, you know what? Sean McVay is kind of propping him up a little bit. So they trade Goff to Detroit. They get Matt Stafford in, who everybody would acknowledge is better than Jared Goff, and they win a Super Bowl. And all of a sudden, the offense that McVay has been running looks even better than it did with Goff. So, you know, sometimes it's not just is the quarterback good or not. It is the quarterback-coach combination operating at its highest level and its greatest productivity? And we're not going to know that yet until the season starts with Hurts and Sirianni.
Interesting you bring up all the quarterbacks since Jeff Lurie got here, coaches quarterbacks, because the only one who actually got to pick his own quarterback was basically Andy Reid.
Yeah. I mean, Doug liked,
did too. Yeah.
Yeah, Doug liked Wentz. He had a lot of input on that. You know, and look, for a while it looked like it was working, you know, and
it was the best regular season ever by an Eagle quarterback.
Yeah, it really was. He was going to be the MVP, and everything that's happened since then, understandably, like, covers up that fact, but he was really terrific that one year.
Right. Interesting enough, that brings us to this day in Eagle history.
Go for it.
All right, so this day in Eagles, September 3rd, 2016, the Eagles traded Sam Bradford to Minnesota for a first-round draft pick in 2017.
I remember that.
Howie Roseman had traded up from, was it 16 to 8 to 2?
Yes.
16 to 8 to 2 to draft Carson Wentz. So Howie continued to clean up a mess that was left for him by Chip Kelly by ridding him of Bradford was a terrible fit with it. He traded Bradford, or they got Bradford from St. Louis they traded Nick Foles and a second round pick.
Yes. Now, having said this, is Sam Bradford a great NFL quarterback? No. Obviously not. Having said that, the Eagles were 7-6 in the games that he started and finished for them that season, 2015.
Bradford.
They finished the season 7-9. In part because Bradford missed several games with a concussion, I believe it was.
Which is surprising that the guy would get hurt. Missed two seasons with torn ACLs.
Exactly. And to me, I always chuckled and, you know, laughed in the aftermath of the Eagles going after Carson Wentz and Bradford demanding the trade. Like, people went apoplectic over Sam Bradford demanding a trade, where it's like, do you all follow pro sports? Like, the guy can read the writing on the wall.
He drafted him number 2 overall. Yeah, you're not going to have him sit that long.
Right. Carson Wentz is going to play. The job is Carson Wentz's. Sam Bradford wants a chance to go play somewhere else. Any athlete in his position would do exactly the same thing. And people acted like he was disloyal or wasn't tough enough. Like, the guy came back from like 2 or 3 knee surgeries. He was tough enough. He got injured too much.
He was not a good fit here either.
No.
But the reason why they traded him, and because he was going to be the starting quarterback that year, and Chase Daniel was going to be the backup. Carson Wentz would barely get on the field, if at all. but Teddy Bridgewater blew out his knee in Minnesota.
I'm still skeptical about how long they would have waited before getting Wentz in there. The Chase Daniel move, I'll never understand. He is an all-time Hall of Famer when it comes to earning money in the NFL.
Getting rewarded for nothing.
Yeah, getting rewarded for not being a great quarterback. But kudos to him because he, you know, he made a lot of money while he was here.
So that happened this day in Eagle history. They traded Sam Bradford and all this. All the give Howie credit for anything else. The fact that he cleaned up a mess, got a team to win a Super Bowl.
Yeah.
With what was left for him by Chip Kelly was pretty amazing.
Yeah, it was. And I give him a little bit of credit. It's kind of like, do you want to blame him for setting the fire, or do you want to blame him or credit him for putting it out, right? Like, they misread Wentz. They committed a whole lot of money and a whole lot of years to him, and then drafted Jalen Hurts, and he lost his mind and wanted to be traded. The fact that they are back to where they are now is perceived to be a playoff team and contenders is a credit to Howie Roseman and how he's reshaped them. Because they went into that contract thinking, like, Carson Wentz is going to be our guy for the next 5 to 10 years. And they had to completely reverse course once he decided he didn't want to play here anymore.
It's my contention they fired Doug Peterson to appease Carson Wentz and didn't read the room that Carson Wentz didn't like Howie either.
I don't know how true that is. I'm not saying you're right or wrong. I don't know how true that is. But I did write after the last game of that season, if you remember, it was the quote-unquote tanking game against Washington. And there was a report by ESPN's Chris Mortensen that Wentz wanted to be traded. And that was it. You got to do it. You know, he didn't want to play for Doug anymore. Wentz apparently had said, and or his representatives had said, and yeah, you had to do it. And it's wild to think that's how it ended, given all the expectations and joy that accompanied Carson Wentz when he showed up.
In most cases, when somebody says they want to be traded, you have no choice.
Yeah.
In Kevin Durant's case, they had no takers, or not. No one's going to pay enough for him.
Right. Right. And I'm not even sure how aggressively the Nets were looking to trade Kevin Durant. I think it might have just been, yeah, sure, Kevin, we're trying to trade you, whatever.
Let's get Clay in Kansas City on. Clay, you're 94 WIP.
Hey, guys, how you doing?
Hi, Clay.
You guys were talking about, and I've seen a lot of Jalen Reagor. You know, I'm a Midwest guy, watch a lot of Big 12. I didn't like it when they drafted him, but he really did. Something happened to that guy. Because, man, in college, he was really a difference maker on the field. He was fast. So I didn't hate it, but spinning him then for what they got for him, because, I mean, let's face it, we all thought they were just going to outright release the guy, because I don't think you could have brought him back into that wide receiver room. I mean, I don't know what your guys' thoughts on that are, but he just didn't fit.
Yeah, I think given the wide receiver room now, Clay, I mean, he was at best the fourth or fifth guy, you know, in terms of talent, in terms of, you know, accomplishments, all that kind of thing. So, yeah, I'm with you in that. They got more for him than I thought they would get for him. To me, he reminds me, and this is in some way unfair to the person whose name I'm about to mention, he reminds me of Nelson Aguilar in this regard. When Aguilar was with the Eagles for the first couple of years he was here, he struggled with drops, and he struggled with the fact that physically he was not quite as dominant in the NFL as he had been in college. And it wasn't until he took an offseason and really, like, built himself up a little bit so that he was more athletic that all of a sudden he started getting to the spot on the field that he needed to be without thinking about it and catching the ball without thinking about it. And he didn't have to try so hard. And he talked about that season and when the Eagles won the Super Bowl. And I wonder if Reagor was going through something similar where he just felt like, you know, the difference between him and his competitors athletically was not nearly as great in the NFL, and it hampered him in some way.
Yeah, I would agree. And then I will say the roster is very deep this year. I mean, it feels a little bit like the 2017 roster. It's really deep. And then the last comment I'll make, I have not watched tennis in 20 years. I've been watching Serena. I grew up in the 80s. I watched Jimmy Connors make his run at the U.S. Open. I mean, I watched last night, but I won't watch again because tennis is kind of dead to me. It's boring now. So, thanks, guys.
Thanks. That's a
thank you, Clay.
Interesting comment, but I haven't watched a lot of tennis either, and I watched last night as well.
Yeah. Well, on the men's side of things, you have three, you know, the kind of the blessed trinity of men's tennis, right, in Roger Federer and Djokovic and Rafael Nadal. So that's been pretty compelling. You know, one or two of those three guys is going to be there at the end, usually. And look, Serena has been around and at the top of her sport for a long time. You know, she and Venus are compelling personalities and stories, and so great. So different from what the stereotype of a
tennis player
once was. So all of that works to their advantages. And I think, like we talked about earlier, Rob, like the whole idea of a once great athlete making a late career push or run, whether you're talking about Jack Nicklaus at the 86 Masters or Tiger Woods a couple of years ago kind of making a comeback or Serena this past week, people eat that stuff up.
And they should. When we come back, we'll talk about what we're watching. WIP Sports Time, 1124.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer.
SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait. There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino
and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
Oh, Larry David.
Oh, yeah.
I like
that. Yeah. Right. Glenn recut that a couple of weeks ago when I joined the show, and I love it. I love the almost famous reference, I Am a Golden God. It's one of my all-time favorite movies. So, yeah, this has quickly become, you know, probably my favorite segment on the show that Glenn and I do. The
segment is called What We're Watching. It's sponsored by Guided Door and Window. Take advantage of Guided Door and Window's big summer sales event. Receive 40% off all windows and doors. Call 1-877-GO-GUIDA or visit goguida.com. Well, I can tell you what I've been watching is Serena.
Yeah.
So I've been watching the tennis. But it's not, it's, I mean, the Open is a 2-week thing, and I think I'm done because Serena's done. So let's ask what you're watching.
Sure. So this past week, I've been, since starting on with Glenn, I've been consuming one after another documentaries on Netflix. And they have a really cool sports documentary series there called Untold. They did one a couple of weeks ago, Glenn and I talked about the Manti Te'o story from 2012, about how he got catfished, and that was really good. And I watched one this week called Operation Flagrant Foul, and it is all about Delco's own Tim Donaghy.
The referee.
The referee who bet on games while he was with the NBA, reffing games in the NBA. And I enjoyed the documentary, but it was kind of a hard watch from the standpoint that nobody in this documentary comes off well at all.
And why should they?
Right. And the sleaze factor of the people who were involved in this operation to bet on games and Donaghy's role in it. Donaghy comes off as the most corrupt and duplicitous one of the group. Where he's kind of evasive answering certain questions. He insists he only made about $30,000 from this whole arrangement, which was ridiculous. There's some interesting kind of review and reveal where it's kind of implied that the NBA and David Stern in particular were the ones who leaked the initial story about the investigation of Donaghy so that they could get out in front of it. So it was an interesting watch. And of course, you know, you're watching this and you're seeing shots of Delaware County and you hear Donaghy talking about the fact that Delco is the home to so many NBA referees.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's kind of a breeding ground there.
Is he implying that others are involved? Or
There is a direct implication that a referee named Scott Foster was involved in some way. Now, Foster was not interviewed for the doc. But the implication is very strongly there. And it does get you thinking about, it's kind of that side of sports that we don't talk about and almost don't look at, unless somebody like Adonahy comes forward and is actually truthful about it. The question is, how truthful was he throughout this whole documentary? It's about an hour and 15 minutes. Yeah. It's worth sitting down and watching. You know, they should have subtitled it like Player of Easttown or something like that, just because it's so Delco. It's so thick.
Was it as good as Mayor of Easttown?
I don't think so. No. I give it 3 stars out of 4. But the reason I don't go higher than that is you're listening to these guys, the ones in particular who were involved in the conspiracy to bet on games and using Donahue's inside information, and you're not 100% sure of how to separate fact from fiction and truth from lie, and that makes it a challenge.
Who produced this?
That's a good question. It's part of a series that Netflix. It's a Netflix original series. I don't know who produced it, but it's worth a watch. It is, especially for basketball fans around here.
Right. There was a Netflix series a couple of years ago that a fellow LaSalle guy produced. Matt Howley and the work, Tom Farrell on The Workshop produced Basketball or Nothing. I don't know if you saw that.
I didn't see it. Matt is a friend of mine. I apologize, Matt, for not watching that documentary. I've been meaning to. I just didn't get around to it. But yeah, I've known Matt a long time. We overlapped a little bit at LaSalle. And he's very, very talented at what he does.
Basketball or Nothing was about Native Americans in Arizona playing for a high school championship.
Yep.
And it's just a fascinating, fascinating series. I think it's like 6 episodes.
Yeah, Matt did a lot of great work. He was here at the ground floor when it started with Comcast Sportsnet.
Yeah.
Did a lot of great work for that network back when that network did a lot of great work. I've been meaning to check it out. I just haven't yet.
It's on Netflix as well. That's about all, you know, like I said, Serena's and the Phillies.
Yeah, you know, I have 2 kids under the age of 11, so
What have they been watching?
They watch a lot of Harry Potter movies. We did watch, back when it was in the theaters, the four of us, my wife and our 2 sons, went to see Top Gun Maverick. And that honestly is the best thing I've seen all year.
And you liked the first one too?
I did, but the sequel is better. The sequel is actually better. In fact, my 2 sons saw the sequel first, and then a week later, I found the original Top Gun on Amazon Prime or something like that, and we watched it. And at the end of it, they were like, that was good, but the second one was better.
Did they change the music or same music?
It's very
Kenny
similar.
Kenny Loggins?
Yeah. No, Kenny. They do play Danger Zone at the beginning of the sequel.
Right.
It's got the perfect balance of like nostalgia for the first movie and then moving the story forward. And once the movie's been out a while, I think people who have seen it can more openly discuss what I think is the big unspoken twist in the middle of the movie, which I'm not going to say on the air because not everybody has seen it yet, even though it feels like everybody's seen it. But I think it's an instant classic. I just thought it was the coolest experience I've had in a movie theater in years.
And you've seen the Adam Sandler, the Basketball Scout movie?
I saw Hustle and loved it.
I did too. Some people didn't like it. I loved it.
No, I thought it was really well written. It has that one line that, you know, I'm sure has been repeated 1,000 times since the movie came out. You know, Philadelphia fans are the worst. That's what makes them the best, is that they're the worst. Something along those lines. But yeah, I loved Hustle. I thought it was great.
Yeah, I thought it was very, very well done. And I guess the complaint is you hear that, well, only people in Philadelphia would like it.
No.
I disagree.
I think basketball fans everywhere would love it. I think it hits all the right notes of Philadelphia, great shots of the Manionk Wall, and it gets the city right.
Wish I'd been an extra.
Yeah,
it would have been cool. Town. Yeah. All right, that's what we're watching. Is there an out cue for this, or just read this again one more time? Sponsored by Guided Door and Window. Take advantage of Guided Door and Window's big summer sales event. Visit, receive 40% off all windows and doors. Call 1-877-GO-GUIDA or visit GUIDA.com. All right, back to the phones. Let's get Jason of Westchester. Jason, you're on 94 WIP.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate it.
You got it, Jason.
So earlier you guys asked what athlete or team you wished or we wish that you guys would cover more on WIP, and I have to chime in and be an advocate for a team right here in Philadelphia that gets absolutely no attention on WIP, unfortunately, and that would be the Philadelphia Union. Now, just a few statistics. The Union are currently number one in their conference. They just clinched mathematically a playoff spot on Wednesday. They have about, I think it's like a 14-goal differential higher than the team in second place. They've only allowed 21 goals the entire season, and they have a chance, a good chance, I think, of before the Phillies, Eagles, Sixers, or Flyers, of being the next Philadelphia sports team to win a championship. And I think it's a shame that if they were to win a championship, they would maybe get a mention going into or out of a commercial break on WIP. And I think that's a shame.
Why do you think that is? It doesn't get covered.
I honestly don't know. I think there's a lot of people who just don't understand the nuances of soccer. I find it astonishing personally that people will call soccer boring and then they will sit through a four-hour baseball game, personally. I mean, I personally played soccer. I was an NCAA, PIAA soccer referee for 5 years. And my son and I, we go to Union games regularly, and it is a really enjoyable sport to watch if you understand it. So I think if more people understood the game, they would, you go to a Union game and the stands are packed. It is a popular sport. It's the number one sport in the world, really. And, I think it gets overshadowed by, the more covered sports, the Big Four. And I just, that's my personal opinion.
All right. Thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Yeah, Jason, I think there's a lot of merit to what you're saying in terms of the attention that isn't brought to bear. I have to admit, I have never written or covered a Union match, but I do hear more and more from friends and people who I know in the Philadelphia area who love going to Union matches, particularly parents, as Jason kind of alluded to. It's, from what I understand, it's an incredible environment to bring kids. The stadium is beautiful. The view is beautiful there. They do a great job of game presentation. And he's right. The Union are 16-4-9. They've outscored their opponents 61-21, which is the highest, goal differential in the entire, Major League Soccer. They're unbeaten at home. It's a great story. And I think it's interesting to think about, like, the way the Fires caught on quickly when the NHL expanded here, and the fact that the Union haven't reached that kind of popularity. You're comparing the late 60s, early 70s to the 21st century, but I wonder if there are factors there that overlap or really differentiate those two things.
Well, interesting you bring up the Flyers, because we used to say this about, Flyers used to sell at all their games, mm-hmm. but we used to say the reason why we talk more basketball than hockey, the winter sports, is because more people care about basketball or played basketball than hockey. Was just like the people going to the games care about it, but nobody else seems to care much about it.
Yeah.
It's not a great TV sport. It's actually a very good radio sport, but it's also obviously one of the things you got to see in person because it's just tough to follow on TV.
Yeah. I think we could take this any number of directions in terms of, where people go to discuss sports nowadays, whether you're talking about a talk radio station, social media, texting with their friends, all of that kind of stuff. And that certain things will move the needle. The Eagles are the big dogs in town. When the Phillies are good, baseball becomes very popular. We've seen what happens in the past when the Sixers make a run. The 2000-2001 season with Allen Iverson, you saw Sixers flags everywhere. When they got back to the playoffs with Embiid and Simmons, there was a charge, in the region about the Sixers. So maybe it's simply a matter of time for the Union that they will eventually become a bigger deal.
Well, here's the deal. A lot of kids grow up playing soccer. A ton of kids grow up playing soccer because soccer has become, a good high school sport. It's a good sport for kids to play. But it's still never caught on like baseball, basketball, and football.
Yeah, yeah. But it's an interesting point about baseball, though. You're right. I mean, I don't pay as close attention to baseball as I once did, and the changes in the sport and the way that it's slowed down are a big reason why.
And maybe the fact that the national team is not that good. I mean, if there are a women's league, there have been women's leagues, the women's national team is better to follow than the men because the men are never in the World Cup.
Yeah, that's fair, too. Maybe that's it. I don't know.
All right, 215-592-9494. WIP Sports Time, 1142. 94 WIP, Rob Cherry in for Glenn Macnow with Mike Sielski. Well, it's Saturday midday. Now, joining us on the lines right now is Dr. Mark Pollard from Cooper Bone and Joints. We can discuss some of the injuries that we're concerned about. Mike, what's the one that's got you most concerned right now?
I got to ask Dr. Pollard about Zach Wheeler and this lingering soreness that apparently, not apparently, is going to push back his start and cause him to be reevaluated. Dr. Pollard, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
Yeah, what are we to make of this? How alarmed should Phillies fans be?
Well, I mean, it's always worrisome when there's kind of an injury that just doesn't seem to be able to go away. From what I understand, this has been kind of an ongoing thing. I thought that I heard that he had gotten an MRI previously. I thought it was his elbow.
Yes.
And obviously that's always a concern with pitchers. But I thought he had an MRI that was pretty clean, you know, showing no structural damage. So that's always reassuring. But, you know, even if you have a clean MRI, that doesn't mean that you don't have symptoms. And, you know, the worry is, you know, is there pain that's kind of showing up before there's anything visible on an MRI? And if there is pain, does it alter the throwing mechanics enough that he can hurt something else, like his shoulder or something? So, you know, it is always concerning when something just doesn't seem to be able to go away.
So, just for clarity, there was an MRI that showed inflammation. You know, is that what you're talking about when you're saying the MRI is pretty clean, that, you know, no structural damage, but, you know, there is something going on there still?
Yeah, I mean, you know, no. The big concern would be is if there was, you know, a tear, like a torn ligament is the most common thing. But also, you know, some of the area where a muscle attaches to bone can also kind of work its way loose. And so those would be kind of the big structural things. Obviously, inflammation is, you know, nonspecific. It does show that something's going on. So something's happening to the point that, you know, the tissue is irritated enough to, you know, get, you know, extra swelling in it, which is what the inflammation is. So, you know, it's especially if, you know, that lingers after rest, that somewhat of concern.
And they originally said 15 days, and they were hoping he'd be able to start September 6th. They've already pushed that back a few days. Is there any reason for concern for that? Is just that maybe something being a little cautious there?
I think it's probably just an abundance of caution. You know, everything, you know, have to take everything in the big picture. And if there's, you know, they don't want this thing to kind of continue to linger if they get to the, you know, the end of the season push or the postseason, hopefully. And so, you know, they probably willing to sacrifice a few starts now to have him, you know, fresh and, you know, 100% later.
Right. Miles Sanders, lingering hamstring injury. Concern about something like that, the fact that he still hasn't practiced? Not fully.
It depends. It's kind of, to me at least, it's tough to read how things are being handled, you know, in the preseason. You know, some teams don't really play their starters at all in the preseason and don't have them practice very hard, you know, again, trying to preserve them for the regular season, whereas other teams, you know, take the opposite approach, kind of like boot camp. And so it's difficult to know what to make of it. Obviously, you know, a hamstring injury that won't go away, you know, is concerning, because that's the kind of thing that can keep on, you know, getting aggravated, and that, you know, the timeline for, you know, full function can keep getting pushed back. So if it is indeed, you know, a hamstring injury that's significant, that's not getting better, that would be, you know, cause for concern.
Dr. Pollard, one other question I have. It's not about a local athlete, but I was talking with a friend of mine about an injury that a basketball player had, lottery pick had, that seems
Chet
like
Holmgren.
Yeah, a Liz Frank injury. Is that something that he was saying that it's a couple years before you can actually be yourself? Is that the type of injury that you never fully recover from, or you can fully recover from, but it takes more than a year or so?
Well, there's a spectrum of how bad a Liz Frank injury can be. You know, that's referring to the Liz Frank joint, and which is kind of the mid portion of your foot. You know, further up than the toes, but farther down than the ankle. Some of the, you know, the small bones in the foot, and so there's some strong ligaments that hold that together. Normally, they hold up, but it takes a lot of force to injure those, and that can be, you know, it can be a devastating injury at times. And, you know, the recovery time can, depending on how severe it is and what treatment needs to be done, a lot of times surgery is required, and that can take a long time to get better, especially for somebody, you know, basketball, you can't exactly put like a stiff sole shoe necessarily on the foot, and, you know, like a lineman might be able to, and just go forward as best you can. You know, that can, it can take a couple a while, maybe even a couple of years on the outside.
And if you're 7 foot, is it a lot worse?
Well, it stands to reason that the bigger you are, the longer your limbs are, the more force is going to be put on there. So, you know, that's probably contributed to it happening in the first place and also might make it a little bit more challenging to heal it up.
Dr. Pollard, thank you so much. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Dr. Mark Pollard from Cooper Bone and Joint.
You know, you mentioned Liz Frank. Those are two of the worst words in professional sports. Anytime you hear that an athlete has got a Liz Frank, you just say, oh, man. I remember, I think Deuce Staley had
one. Yeah, it was.
Maybe Todd Herriman's with the Eagles. You see it frequently in football and in basketball. And every time I say to myself, oh, my gosh, that athlete's got a long recovery ahead of him or her to get back to where they want to be.
And if you look at the frame of Chet Holmgren, he's 7 foot, like 195 something.
Yeah, it's crazy.
He doesn't look like he's got the body that could hold up. And game in Seattle.
Pro-Am game, in Seattle.
He just crumbled, backpedaling, covering LeBron James.
Yeah, and he's going to miss the entire season. It's kind of a Joel Embiid-esque situation there.
He could miss too.
Yeah.
For all we know.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the phones here. Bob in Delran, you're on 94 WIP.
Hey, I wanted to make a couple of points. And I know with the younger generation, it's about social media. But if you're a professional athlete, and I spoke to, I think it was Ruben Frank, it said something. And I asked him, can the coaches approach them and say, now, a player can do anything he wants as long as it's, you know, ethical and not against the law. I get that. But a coach does have the right to say, hey, look, you're on social media a lot. We would prefer you not to be on it or reading it about yourself and the team. Other subjects, go for it. Because some guys can handle it, criticism, and others can't. Jalen Reagor, my understanding of what I'm hearing, is he couldn't handle all the stuff that we say and hear, and he just didn't have the discipline to shut it down. And some guys can do it, some guys can't.
Go ahead, Ben.
And it's sad because maybe the kid has some talent, and he does have talent, obviously. I'm not saying it's going to be Justin Jefferson. But my point is this. There's got to be some way in the interview process for draft prospects that they can – and I know they're going to – that they got to describe Howie or whoever does the interviews for these prospects, say, look, we got a crazy fan base. They're going to say things and hear things probably over and above or over the top. If you can handle that type of culture, welcome. If you can't, nothing wrong with that. We're nuts. We're crazy. You maybe want to go in another direction, or the team's got to think, I don't know about this guy. He can handle it mentally. How much does that play in them selecting a player? He can have all the talent, but if he lets all this crap that, you know, like talk radio, myself, media, some guys can't handle it, and they can't play here.
Yeah, I think you make a great point, Bob, and I think the challenge with that is finding a procedure or an insight that allows a team to know whether a guy is going to be, an athlete is going to be able to handle playing in a
tough
market.
Which is their job. When they draft a guy that high or when they draft a guy, that should be part of their job. Markel Fultz is a prime example. I guess you could say Ben Simmons as well, but Markel Fultz especially.
Yeah, but it's a really challenging thing to figure out, right? Like, and teams and franchises are getting better at it. You know, I mean, the example I always use in this regard is, Peyton Manning and Ryan Leaf was like a real debate before the 1998 draft, and Ryan Leaf has come a long way since he was that kid, but man, you can't find two personalities more disparate than those two guys, and yet there was an actual debate about, like, well, maybe Ryan Leaf would be a better pick than Peyton Manning, and part of the reason Leaf was a bust was that he couldn't handle simply the pressure of playing in the NFL, and it is something that gets discussed at that level amongst general managers, owners, coaches, all of that. But the challenge is figuring out, like, is there a way to determine how an athlete is going to react in these high-pressure situations? And it's especially hard now with social media, as Bob mentioned. I mean, these athletes are just inundated with feedback, and if they aren't disciplined enough and can't control and manage that flow of criticism, it can get to them. Look at Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant's on Twitter all the time. And it's one of those things that he allows to kind of seep into his brain, and maybe, you know, it affects him in one way or another.
Yeah, but is it unfair to say, well, can you handle Philadelphia? When this happens just about every city.
Nowadays,
so maybe,
it does.
Maybe a little more intense here, but it happens just about every city.
Yeah, nowadays it does. And it's something that teams, it's an imperfect science in terms of figuring out how to figure out what an athlete brings to the table mentally, emotionally, psychologically.
Mentally, they have to be strong.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, to get to a certain level, they have to be mentally strong anyway, but mentally, they have to be strong to block everything out and not worry about what's being said about them.
Right, and you don't know what they're going to encounter once they get to the highest level of their sport. You know, I mentioned earlier about Nelson Aguilar needing to physically kind of remake himself so that he could play with the same level of confidence and speed in the NFL that he'd played at in college. I think Markelle Fultz was another example of that. I think part of the reason that Fultz got the yips over shooting the ball with the Sixers was that all of a sudden, at the NBA level, he couldn't get to spots on the floor or get his shot off with the ease that he once could in high school and college. And he was a kid who had made a really fast rise from like his sophomore year of high school to his 1 year at Washington to being the number one overall pick in the draft. And all of a sudden, he's at the first level of basketball that he's encountered where it's like, oh my gosh, these guys are bigger and stronger and can bump me off my spot. And what do I do about that? And physically, he wasn't ready yet to counteract it, and it led to kind of a mental problem for him.
I watched tape of him and some other high school players back then, Miles Bridges and several others as well, that seemed like the top prospects.
Mm-hmm.
And watching him, I was like, this guy's the best of all of them.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Clearly, you know,
something went haywire.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it really did. And I feel bad for the kid. And in some ways, to Bob's point about this being a tough place to play, I mean, there were people at Sixers games cheering for Markelle Fultz to attempt a three-point shot or a jump shot, which is both good and bad, right? On the one hand, fans are showing their support. They want him to do well. They understand that he is struggling with something. The flip side of that is it was kind of condescending almost. It was like, we're cheering you just for doing the thing that a basketball player like you is supposed to do.
We're not bad fans. We're just, you know, trying to encourage you there.
Our intentions are good, but maybe it doesn't help as much as we'd like to think it does.
215-592-9494. WIP Sports Time is 12 o'clock.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. T&Cs apply.
You know, over the years, I've seen it all. So now, I'm sharing it all. Join me for Unfiltered Talks with the names you love on my new podcast, On Par with Maury Povich. Follow and listen to On Par wherever you get your podcasts.
94 WIP, Rob Cherry in for Glenn Mack now with Mike Sielski on a Saturday midday. Now, joining us on the lines right now is Dr. Mark Pollard from Cooper Bone and Joints. We can discuss some of the injuries that we're concerned about. Mike, what's the one that's got you most concerned right now?
I got to ask Dr. Pollard about Zach Wheeler and this lingering soreness that apparently, is going to push back his start and cause him to be reevaluated. Dr. Pollard, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
Yeah, what are we to make of this? How alarmed should Phillies fans be?
Well, I mean, it's always worrisome when there's kind of an injury that just doesn't seem to be able to go away. From what I understand, this has been kind of an ongoing thing. I thought that I heard that he had gotten an MRI previously. I thought it was his elbow.
Yes.
And obviously that's always a concern with pitchers. But I thought he had an MRI that was pretty clean, you know, showing no structural damage. So that's always reassuring. But, you know, even if you have a clean MRI, that doesn't mean that you don't have symptoms. And, you know, the worry is, you know, is there pain that's kind of showing up before there's anything visible on an MRI? And if there is pain, does it alter the throwing mechanics enough that he can hurt something else, like his shoulder or something? So, you know, it is always concerning when something just doesn't seem to be able to go away.
So just for clarity, there was an MRI that showed inflammation. You know, is that what you're talking about when you're saying the MRI is pretty clean, that, you know, no structural damage, but, you know, there is something going on there still.
Yeah, I mean, you know, no, the big concern would be is if there was, you know, a tear, like a torn ligament is the most common thing, but also, you know, some of the area where a muscle attaches to bone can also kind of work its way loose. And so those would be kind of the big structural things. Obviously, inflammation is, you know, nonspecific. It does show that something's going on. So something's happening to the point that, you know, the tissue is irritated enough to, you know, get, you know, extra swelling in it, which is what the inflammation is. So, you know, it's a, especially if, you know, that lingers after rest, that somewhat of concern.
And they originally said 15 days, and they were hoping he'd be able to start September 6th. They've already pushed that back a few days. Is there any reason for concern for that? Is just that maybe something being a little cautious there?
I think it's probably just an abundance of caution. You know, everything, you know, have to take everything in the big picture. And if there's, you know, they don't want this thing to kind of continue to linger if they get to the, you know, the end of the season push or the postseason, hopefully. And so, you know, they'd probably willing to sacrifice a few starts now to have him, you know, fresh and, you know, 100% later.
Right. Miles Sanders, lingering hamstring injury. Concern about something like that, the fact that he still hasn't practiced? Not fully.
It depends. It's kind of, to me at least, it's tough to read how things are being handled, you know, in the preseason. You know, some teams don't really play their starters at all in the preseason and don't have them practice very hard, you know, again, trying to preserve them for the regular season, whereas other teams, you know, take the opposite approach, kind of like boot camp. And so it's difficult to know what to make of it. Obviously, you know, a hamstring injury that won't go away, you know, is concerning, because that's the kind of thing that can keep on, you know, getting aggravated, and that the timeline for, you know, full function can keep getting pushed back. So if it is indeed, you know, a hamstring injury that's significant, that's not getting better, that would be, you know, cause for concern.
Dr. Pollard, one other question I have, it's not about a local athlete, but I was talking with a friend of mine about an injury that a basketball player had, lottery pick had, that
yes,
seems
Chet
like
Holmgren.
Yeah, a Liz Frank injury. Is that something that he was saying that it's a couple years before you can actually be yourself? Is that the type of injury that you never fully recover from, or you can fully recover from, but it takes more than a year or so?
Well, there's a spectrum of how bad a Liz Frank injury can be. You know, that's referring to the Liz Frank joint, and which is kind of the mid portion of your foot. You know, further up than the toes, but farther down than the ankle. Some of the, you know, the small bones in the foot, and so there's some strong ligaments that hold that together. Normally they hold up, but it takes a lot of force to injure those, and that can be, you know, it can be a devastating injury at times. And, you know, the recovery time can, depending on how severe it is and what treatment needs to be done, a lot of times surgery is required, and that can take a long time to get better, especially for somebody, you know, basketball, you can't exactly put like a stiff sole shoe necessarily on the foot, and you know, like a lineman might be able to, and just go forward as best you can. You know, it can take a couple, a while, maybe even a couple years on the outside.
And if you're 7 foot, is it a lot worse?
Well, it stands to reason that the bigger you are, the longer your limbs are, the more force is going to be put on there. So, you know, that's probably contributed to it happening in the first place, and also might make it a little bit more challenging to heal it up.
Dr. Pollard, thank you so much. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Dr. Mark Pollard from Cooper Bone and Joint.
You know, you mentioned Liz Frank. Those are two of the worst words in professional sports. Anytime you hear that an athlete has got a Liz Frank, you just say, oh, man. I remember, I think Deuce Staley had
yes,
one.
Yes, yeah, it was.
Maybe Todd Herriman's with the Eagles. You see it frequently in football and in basketball. And every time I say to myself, oh, my gosh, that athlete's got a long recovery ahead of him or her to get back to where they want to be.
And if you look at the frame of Chet Holmgren, he's 7 foot, like 195 something.
Yeah, it's crazy.
He doesn't look like he's got the body that could hold up. And in a pro-am game in Seattle, he just crumbled, backpedaling, covering LeBron James.
Yeah, and he's going to miss the entire season. It's kind of a Joel Embiid-esque situation there.
He could miss two.
Yeah.
For all we know.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
All right, let's go back to the phones here. Bob in Delran, you're on 94 WIP.
Hey, I wanted to make a couple of points. And I know with the younger generation, it's about social media. But if you're a professional athlete, and I think it was Ruben Frank that said something, And I asked him, can the coaches approach them and say, now, a player can do anything he wants as long as it's, you know, ethical and not against the law. I get that. But a coach does have the right to say, hey, look, you're on social media a lot. We would prefer you not to be on it or reading it about yourself and the team. Other subjects, go for it. Because some guys can handle it, criticism, and others can't. Jalen Reagor, my understanding of what I'm hearing, is he couldn't handle all the stuff that we say and hear, and he just didn't have the discipline to shut it down. And some guys can do it, some guys can't. And it's sad because maybe the kid has some talent, and he does have talent, obviously. I'm not saying it's going to be Justin Jefferson. But my point is this. There's got to be some way in the interview process for draft prospects that they can, and I know they're going to, that they got to describe Howie or whoever does the interviews for these prospects, say, look, we got a crazy fan base. They're going to say things and hear things probably over and above or over the top. If you can handle that type of culture, welcome. If you can't, nothing wrong with that. We're nuts. We're crazy. You maybe want to go in another direction, or the team's got to think, I don't know about this guy. He can handle it mentally. How much does that play in them selecting a player? He can have all the talent, but if he lets all this crap that, you know, like talk radio, myself, media, some guys can't handle it, and they can't play here.
Yeah, I think you make a great point, Bob, and I think the challenge with that is finding a procedure or an insight that allows a team to know whether a guy is going to be, an athlete is going to be able to handle playing in a
tough
market.
Their job. When they draft a guy that high or they draft a guy, that should be part of their job. Markelle Fultz is a prime example. I guess you could say Ben Simmons as well, but Markelle Fultz especially.
Yeah, but it's a really challenging thing to figure out, right? Like, and teams and franchises are getting better at it. You know, I mean, the example I always use in this regard is, Peyton Manning and Ryan Leaf was like a real debate before the 1998 draft, and Ryan Leaf has come a long way since he was that kid, but man, you can't find two personalities more disparate than those two guys, and yet there was an actual debate about, like, well, maybe Ryan Leaf would be a better pick than Peyton Manning, and part of the reason Leaf was a bust was that he couldn't handle simply the pressure of playing in the NFL, and it is something that gets discussed at that level amongst general managers, owners, coaches, all of that. But the challenge is figuring out, like, is there a way to determine how an athlete is going to react in these high-pressure situations? And it's especially hard now with social media, as Bob mentioned. I mean, these athletes are just inundated with feedback, and if they aren't disciplined enough and can't control and manage that flow of criticism, it can get to them. Look at Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant's on Twitter all the time, and it's one of those things that he allows to kind of seep into his brain, and maybe, you know, it affects him in one way or another.
Yeah, but is it unfair to say, well, can you handle Philadelphia? When this happens just about every city.
Nowadays, so
maybe
it does.
Maybe a little more intense here, but it happens just about every city.
Yeah, nowadays it does. And it's something that teams – it's an imperfect science in terms of figuring out how – to figure out what an athlete brings to the table mentally, emotionally, psychologically.
Mentally, they have to be strong.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, to get to a certain level, they have to be mentally strong anyway, but mentally they have to be strong to block everything out and not worry about what's being said about them.
Right, and you don't know what they're going to encounter once they get to the highest level of their sport. You know, I mentioned earlier about Nelson Aguilar needing to physically kind of remake himself so that he could play with the same level of confidence and speed in the NFL that he'd played at in college. I think Markelle Fultz was another example of that. I think part of the reason that Fultz got the yips over shooting the ball with the Sixers was that all of a sudden at the NBA level, he couldn't get to spots on the floor or get his shot off with the ease that he once could in high school and college. And he was a kid who had made a really fast rise from like his sophomore year of high school to his 1 year at Washington to being the number one overall pick in the draft. And all of a sudden he's at the first level of basketball that he's encountered where it's like, oh my gosh, these guys are bigger and stronger and can bump me off my spot. And what do I do about that? And physically he wasn't ready yet to counteract it, and it led to kind of a mental problem for him.
I watched tape of him and some other high school players back then, Miles Bridges and several others as well, that seemed like the top prospects.
Mm-hmm.
And watching him, I was like, this guy's the best of all of them.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Clearly, you know.
Something went haywire.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it really did. And I feel bad for the kid. And in some ways, to Bob's point about this being a tough place to play, I mean, there were people at Sixers games cheering for Markelle Fultz to attempt a three-point shot or a jump shot, which is both good and bad, right? On the one hand, fans are showing their support. They want him to do well. They understand that he is struggling with something. The flip side of that is it was kind of condescending almost. It was like, we're cheering you just for doing the thing that a basketball player like you is supposed to do.
We're not bad fans. We're just, you know, trying to encourage you there.
Our intentions are good, but maybe it doesn't help as much as we'd like to think it does.
215-592-9494. WIP Sports Time is 12 o'clock.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories and lots of laughs.
Follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.